Hi, I'm Michelle, and welcome to The Grateful Podcast. We're here to explore together what it takes to create more just, generative, and even joyful food systems, communities, and lives. And normally I'm joined by a wonderful and inspiring guest, but today it's just me, here to chat with you about a topic that keeps coming up a lot in my work. So I thought it was worth dedicating a whole podcast episode to it. And that topic is resilience. And I actually feel like it's a really relevant topic because I'm sitting down to record this podcast in a podcast tower that's basically a metal tower in the sun. We're in the middle of a heat wave and I feel like a melted marshmallow. So I really feel inside this topic of resilience, particularly our resilience as humans to the shocks that we're going to keep seeing, like heat waves and extreme heat. The last few weeks, I've found myself spending actual time thinking about things like, how can I work when the weather is so hot? How do I deal with elevated fire risk and work out how to evacuate safely? How much are food prices going to continue to rise? So maybe you've also been finding these questions present in your mind as well. At the moment, no matter how much privilege we have, we're all impacted more and more by shocks to our food, to our climate, to all kinds of natural systems. So it just feels like a really important time to talk about this topic of resilience and what it means for each of us individually. Now, this is a topic that's popping up a lot in my work as a leadership coach and an educator and a facilitator who works with change makers, helping them to both drive but also respond to change in a sustainable way. But it's also a topic that I kept finding in my inbox from listeners who were writing in with topics that they would love for me to explore on the podcast. And not only that, I'm also increasingly getting requests to come and talk about resilience to students at universities. So I really feel like it's such a present topic for everyone at the moment. So definitely worth diving into in an episode together today. And in truth, one episode is far too little. We could definitely talk about resilience for days, but I hope that today's episode gives you some food for thought to help you keep diving in a little bit deeper. Now, I'm sure many of you who are listening care a lot about building a more sustainable or more regenerative world. And a big part of that is making our communities and our systems more resilient. But what we often forget when we're talking about those topics or working in those topics is that we can't really have planetary resilience without personal resilience, that the two are actually connected, and that being able to face and even bounce back stronger in the face of adversity and shocks at a global level is linked to everyone actually being able to do that at an individual level. So today I wanted to have a chat about this idea of personal resilience. And I hope that listening to this episode helps you understand what you can focus on if you're interested in building your own resilience, that it helps you reflect on these connections between personal and planetary resilience, and that you leave with some tools and exercises and really concrete things that you can keep working on your own. And I'm going to share some of those tools and resources for you at the end of the episode and give you a link where you can download a workbook if you want to work through it in a structured way. And I'm hearing from listeners that they've really enjoyed some of these journaling questions and exercises and really concrete things to do at the end of the episode. So I'll make sure to keep adding those in for you. I wanted to start today by telling you more about my relationship with resilience. And actually, it was about 10 years ago that I started to work on resilience in a professional capacity as we were working on a project at the university where I was at the time, which was aiming to define what food systems resilience meant. So we had this interdisciplinary team from a lot of different backgrounds, and we were trying to write an academic paper that helps define food systems resilience, but also understand better what does it actually take to build resilience and how can we help people implement these measures to build resilience in food systems. And now, as you can imagine, with all the co-authors being researchers and scientists, we were looking at this topic from a really scientific lens. And although we were considering resilience across levels, so from the individual to global networks, it was much more abstract and theoretical, and we weren't really thinking about what it means for us as individuals within the systems we're studying. And that's actually exactly the work that I've come to do more recently, is to look at how these bigger changes we want to see in the world, how they start with us. And through that, coming to see how central resilience actually is if we want to both lead and respond to change and to build more sustainable food systems and societies on this planet. So if we're interested in resilience at this individual level, this human level, we also have to talk about, what does it actually mean to be human? Very often we forget that we're these multifaceted organisms. We're not just a brain being carried around by a body. We have all these different aspects to ourselves and to our lives, and we actually need to be aware of all of them and pay attention to all of them if we're ever going to build our own resilience. And something that I think is a really simple model that can help us bear in mind the different aspects we need to think about when considering what it means to be human is something called the Spire Wellbeing Model. So this Spire Wellbeing Model was created from a collaboration between Tal Ben-Shahar, who you might know as a teacher and a writer of positive psychology, together with the Whole Being Institute. And Spire is just a really nice acronym that helps us remember these different elements of being human in an easy way. So let me run you through this acronym and share the five different aspects of being human that each letter refers to. So the S in Spire stands for spiritual. And this is all about, how can we lead a life of meaning and purpose while being connected to something bigger than our individual selves and being in the present moment? The P in Spire stands for physical. And that's all about caring for our body, recognizing the connection between our mind and our body and our emotions, and recognizing somatic wisdom, the wisdom and the intelligence that comes from our body. The I in Spire stands for intellectual. So this is everything related to the cognitive space in our lives, engaging in deep learning, remaining open to new experiences, developing, being curious. The R in Spire is all about everything relational. So our relations to others and to ourselves, and how can we nurture constructive relationships and be in connection in a healthy way. And the final letter is E, which stands for emotional. So feeling and recognizing and processing our emotions, seeing our emotions as a source of information and being able to work with that. And for us as humans to find any sense of well-being, we really need to be able to consider and work with all of these different aspects of our lives: the spiritual, the physical, the intellectual, the relational, and the emotional. And by taking all of that into account, that's when we can really find a greater sense of well-being. And these aspects of being human also help us learn more about what it is that we need. And all of those things that I've just mentioned, we can really easily see that actually all of those aspects of our lives are increasingly being exposed to shocks or things that can destabilize us. So I don't need to be the one that tells you that we are facing this overwhelming number of cascading crises at the moment. Some people really depict them like waves. Maybe you've seen that cartoon that's going around at the moment that shows this small wave of the pandemic and then a bigger wave behind it of food insecurity, then a bigger wave of a cost of living crisis, a bigger wave of conflicts, a bigger wave of climate change, a bigger wave of biodiversity loss, and so on and so forth. Just really encapsulating this idea that we're facing so many connected challenges as human beings. And I think that diagram really sums up what someone once described life as one damn thing after another. And at the moment, we really are confronting these challenges on a scale that we haven't really seen in any of our lifetimes. And with all those cascading shocks, it just means that all these different aspects of being human are all going to be impacted in some way or another. And that's why it's increasingly important for us to understand what building our own resilience is. How can we cope with and adapt to stresses and shocks and changes in a way that maintains or ideally improves our well-being, not only individually, but also collectively as humans? And that's maybe an important thing to realize about resilience. It's not a trait that you either have or you don't have. You're not a resilient person or not a resilient person. Resilience really involves behaviors and thoughts and actions that can be learned and developed in anyone, which is a great space for us to start engaging with this topic. So given that we find ourselves in this context where all the different things we need for our well-being are increasingly exposed to different stresses and shocks, what can we do? How can we cultivate and learn and develop these things that build our own resilience? Now, I think that's important for any human on the planet at the moment, but if you're listening to this podcast and you either are or hope to be a change maker, there's another layer to this topic that's relevant for you. Because if you want to play a role in creating change in some way, shape, or form, it can come with this double burden. Because on the one hand, like every citizen on this planet, you're going to be continually responding to change. It's the only inevitable part of the human experience. Change is the only constant, as the ancient Greek philosophers were already telling us. And particularly with these big waves of change coming our way, these big stresses and shocks that are compounding, we're going to continually have to put a lot of resources into our own resilience and into how we respond and how we bounce back. But as change makers, it goes beyond that, because if we want to lead change, then we're also trying to shift systems and move things to more sustainable and regenerative states. That means we're not only responding to change, but we're also trying to drive it. And that places even greater demands on your own resilience, because it might mean that your day-to-day work involves trying to change what is, facing resistance, working maybe directly in a context where there's a lot of risks or where systems aren't in place that help people to be resilient. So I think this topic is already important, but extra important for anybody that cares about their own role in driving change. So with all that said and done, what actually builds our resilience? To work with that, we have to understand what is resilience. And I think that's really interesting, because this term resilience has become a word that, as Parul Segal actually wrote in the New York Times, that resilience is a word that is somehow so conveniently vacant that it manages to be profound and profoundly hollow. And I think those words are so true, because even though I've been working with this term for a long time, I really have that feeling sometimes of like, well, what is this actually about? And what is it not about? And how do we actually work with it? And we might understand the definition of resilience. It's about this ability to cope with whatever life throws at you and bounce back stronger than before. It's about a process and an outcome of successfully adapting despite challenging circumstances. All those definitions sound really nice, but what does that actually mean in practice? What does it mean in my day-to-day life, in your day-to-day life? What actually builds resilience? And what's actually backed up by science, and what are more urban legends or myths? So to help us navigate this jungle and find something useful on the other side, I actually wanted to share with you today 6 insights from research about resilience that can help us understand and apply this term in our own lives. And these 6 things that I've chosen to share are all what I think are interesting insights from research that have really helped me to understand this term and work with it. So I hope you find it useful in the same way. So the first insight is that resilience isn't just about you. This might be a pretty obvious one for some of you. This idea that your resilience is influenced by things happening inside of you, but also things happening outside of you. Both internal and external factors are important. And that might sound obvious, but it's actually a shift that happened relatively recently in the research around resilience. It was more or less in the mid-90s that this recognition became more widely understood, that if we want to talk about building resilience, we need to actually acknowledge that resilience isn't just about these internal factors. It's not just about speaking nice words to ourselves in the mirror. It's not only about the thought patterns that are going on in our mind, but it actually has to be considered hand in hand with external factors. The context we're in, the systems we're in, the networks and support we do or don't have, and access to the resources that each of us as human beings need in order to be resilient and to meet these different needs that we have in these different aspects of our lives. And maybe you've experienced this yourself or seen it with people that you know. Maybe there's somebody who has this incredible internal strength and belief in themselves and incredible coping mechanisms, but they have to do three jobs to cover their basic costs. They don't have access to health insurance. They face systemic racism. And there's only so far then that the internal stuff can take them when, for example, they're faced with the shock of a health diagnosis or a health issue. And then maybe you know people on the other extreme, people that have all the resources and all the support and all the safety nets and opportunities in the world. But internally, they're filled with narratives that doubt themselves, that are extremely pessimistic about the world, that don't help them see possibilities around them. Then it doesn't matter how privileged their context is. They aren't really able to respond or be flexible in the face of shocks. And so that's been an interesting shift in the research about resilience in the recent years, to understand that we have to look at both these internal and external factors. And that means that yes, we have to change things internally when we're talking about resilience, but we also need to be able to get support externally or change the systems around us that are impeding our ability to be resilient. And it also goes the other way, that we can't just blame everything on our context or the systems around us. We have to change things internally to get into a more empowered state. And we always need these two. So that's important for ourselves. But it's also really important for us to think about when we're building systems that we want to be more sustainable and more resilient. And if we want to serve others, we have to always be thinking about both the internal and the external factors for people. And very often what I see in research projects or resilience intervention projects is a focus on one or the other, but very rarely actually are bringing them together. So I think that's a very interesting area to explore. And if you're someone who loves metaphors as much as I do, maybe this metaphor helps you understand this concept. There's this really great quote, which I love, from Jon Kabat-Zinn, which says, "We can't stop the waves, but we can learn to surf." And as we've seen, we've got more and more of these waves coming in humanity's direction. But this quote reminds us that despite these waves, we can learn to surf, we can ride them out, we can let them carry us forward, even if it means some wobbles along the way. And I think this quote speaks a lot to the internal states that can help us build resilience. But as Michael Ungar says, and he's a well-known resilience researcher, that, well, yes, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. And surfing's much easier when you have a board, when you have a surfing coach, a lifeguard, and all these other external factors and resources that we essentially need if we're going to be able to be resilient in the face of the waves that are coming our way. So I think that's just an important first thing for us to bear in mind when we're talking about what builds resilience, that it's both these internal and external factors, and we need resources and attention for both. I'm going to talk a little bit more today in terms of things that we can work with that support these internal factors, but I hope that you can still bear in mind how important these external factors are as well. The second insight I wanted to share is that resilience is an outcome. So sometimes when we're talking about resilience, it's used as if it's a trait of someone, like someone is or isn't resilient, but resilience is actually an outcome. So when we're talking about resilience, we're always asking resilience of what and to what. And so when we're talking about individual or personal resilience, we also need to be asking resilience of whom and to what. Because it's only ever in the face of a particular shock that we can see if there's resilience or not in that particular context. So maybe you were quite resilient through the whole pandemic and could really bounce back for that, maybe even grow and develop in some way. But when a different shock comes along, like the loss of your job, then there's less resilience in the face of that shock. So that's always important. It's resilience of what and to what. Insight number three is, do we actually know what makes us resilient? So one of the misunderstandings that we often had is that there are only a few people, a select few, who are actually resilient. And you might think of yourself as someone who's not very resilient. Maybe you beat yourself up about it. But the research shows us otherwise. George Bonanno, who's another well-known resilience researcher at Columbia University, talks about this in his book, which is called The End of Trauma: How the New Science of Resilience is Changing How We Think About PTSD. And in this book, he shares that resilience is actually quite common. So after varying amounts of time, 2/3 of people return to normal or to a functioning state after a traumatic event. Those might be different traumatic events. So over time, it might vary how much time, and the pathway might be different, but about 2/3 of people tend to return to normal after a traumatic event. So resilience generally is actually quite common. What we need to get more nuanced and understanding is exactly what I mentioned before, the resilience of what and to what. And that's where we start to see that these general ideas, these general lists of things that build resilience, don't always hold. So if you've ever Googled traits of resilient people, you'll see pages and pages of blog posts and articles where people have written their definition of the top 3, 7, 10, 15, 20 things that they believe are traits of resilient people. There's just endless posts on this and endless numbers of traits or elements. And that's all really nice. Maybe you feel good as you read them and try and tick off the things that you think apply to you. Maybe it's helpful to the people who write these blog posts to position themselves as resilience experts, maybe get mandates from organizations or get clients coming their way to help build resilience. But the difficult thing is, if we look into the research, it's actually really hard to make these general lists about what builds resilience generically. Because, again, we always need to ask resilience of what and to what. And I was actually looking at one of these lists the other day. I think it's one of the top hits when you Google traits of resilient people. And I saw that the author even wrote at the bottom of the blog post, "Just a disclaimer, none of this is based on research. It's based on my personal experience, which also has value." Now, I completely agree that our personal experience has value and it definitely helps us to understand our own resilience in different contexts. But we can't just go and extend our own experience with resilience to say it's valid for everyone else. It's important that we actually look at the literature, the research, what have people taken out of studies, and are those people actually making lists? And the reality is, no, they're not. And that's because of what Bonanno and his colleagues have termed the resilience paradox, which is basically that even though we can identify traits that might correlate with resilient outcomes, we can't really predict who's going to be resilient and who will not be resilient in the face of different shocks with very much accuracy. So there are definitely some traits associated with resilience, with some evidence, but which of those are going to be important in which contexts are not really easy to work out. And basically, in their research, they say that any attempt we make to try and build or enhance resilience by focusing on one or a few of these traits, even if we see that relationship there, it's not going to be very effective. And that's because the set of tools and the traits that you need to utilize in a particular context in the face of a particular shock is different to another one, and it's different to what another person might need in that same context. So these predictors of resilient outcomes only show a really modest effect overall because they're not very beneficial in every situation or at every point in time. Basically, there are many different roads to the same destination, and each of us might need to take a different road. And so that means that actually what we need to do to be resilient must involve some sort of assessment or judgment process, some sort of way of working out moment to moment, what do I actually need here to respond to this particular shock in this particular context? So how do you do that? This is where flexibility comes in. The idea that we need to be flexible in our ability to respond, depending on the shock that we're facing, depending on our context and the resources that we have. And so that's why Bonanno and his colleagues at Columbia, rather than talking about these traits of resilient people, actually talk about flexible self-regulation. The idea that this adjustment to shocks is an ongoing process, and what it requires us to do is flexible self-regulation. And in their research, they've identified two parts of this flexible self-regulation. The first is called the flexibility sequence, and the second is called the flexibility mindset. So let's unpack these two and also see how you can apply them in your life. The flexibility sequence is basically the steps that you follow to be able to do flexible self-regulation. And they might sound a little theoretical, but you can actually really put them into practice. And I'll share an exercise with you so you can do this. Basically, they've identified three steps that need to happen in this flexibility sequence for us to be able to respond. The first step is called context sensitivity. It means that, first of all, in the face of a shock or a stressor, we need to be able to step back and help ourselves understand the context and ourselves in it better. This means asking ourselves, what's actually happening here? What am I feeling? What do I need for this particular issue at this particular moment? And research actually shows our ability to be able to do this context sensitivity is very much related to our levels of anxiety. So if we're not able to do this well, it can be associated with higher levels of anxiety in life. So the first step in the flexibility sequence is understanding what's going on, how am I feeling, what do I need? The second step in the flexibility sequence they call repertoire. And repertoire is basically a toolbox of things that you can draw on. So it's that ability to check in with yourself and then say, okay, what am I actually able to do in this context? What's the toolbox I have internally? What are the resources, the systems, the people, the support that I have externally that I can reach out to? What's the plan I need to follow? And we can obviously build ourselves a bigger toolbox, a bigger repertoire, ideally before we're faced with a shock or a stressor. And it doesn't stop there. There's a third and final step in this flexibility sequence, which they call feedback monitoring. And this is basically once you've assessed what's in your toolbox and you've actually implemented and tried out those things, is to then be able to step back and assess what is and what isn't working. We want to be trying things out, but then we also want to be having this dialogue and feedback with ourselves or with the support of others to evaluate, what's happening now? Is it working? Do I need to adjust? Do I need a different tool? Do I need different support? And then actually making those adjustments or changing those strategies as you need to. So these three steps, context sensitivity, repertoire, and feedback monitoring, are what resilience researchers call the flexibility sequence. And it isn't the case that you just go through these three steps once. You actually often need to circle back and repeat them over and over again so that you can keep adapting and changing, even in the face of the same shock or the same stressor. And what they find in their research is that people who engage with this flexibility sequence, they're the ones who tend to correlate with having resilience in the face of different shocks. So flexibility is actually the mechanism behind resilient outcomes. And what's interesting here is that when we look at these steps, we see that they help us shift from this big, broad, overwhelming situation to really bring us into the present moment. What's happening right now? What can I do? What agency do I have? And this is uplifting. It can reassure us. It can help us step into our own agency and get away from feeling paralyzed or like everything's out of our control. And as a former engineer, I also kind of like the structure that this offers us, these three steps that we can really go through when things feel overwhelming or when we feel like we really need to be able to build our resilience in the face of something. And we don't have to wait for these massive shocks to work with these steps. We can really start playing with them on a daily basis with smaller things that we're facing. But as I mentioned, the other part that's needed for this flexible self-regulation is actually a flexibility mindset. So it's not just about going through those steps, but it's also about having what's called a flexibility mindset. And just a reminder, what is a mindset? So Dr. Ali Crum, who's a professor of psychology at Stanford, defines a mindset as a mental frame or lens that selectively organizes or encodes information for action or inaction. So it's these mental models, ways of seeing things in our head that kind of enable or disable us to take action. It's the attention we pay to certain things or not, which really influence the range of possibilities that we see. And mindsets also include these stories that we tell ourselves about what's possible for us or the world around us. And so a flexibility mindset is a mindset that helps us be flexible in the face of challenges. And in exploring this flexibility mindset, what the research has found is that there are basically three mindset traits or characteristics that are often linked to resilient outcomes. And that basically means that when we see these traits, they're often linked to a person being more resilient in the face of a range of different shocks. So what are these three things? The first one is optimism. Optimism about the future, seeing possibilities. The second thing is confidence. More specifically, confidence in our ability to cope with what we're facing, a belief in ourselves, a trust in ourselves. And the third one is a willingness to think about a threat as a challenge. So seeing it as an opportunity to learn, to grow, to adapt. And I think all of those things make sense. When we face something challenging, it can be really easy to want to avoid it, to not want to engage with it. And these things help us keep us focused on it and to see the issue and the possibilities and connect to the possible action that we can take. The most encouraging part is that research shows us that all three of these things, optimism, confidence, willingness to see it as a challenge, they can all be learned and cultivated. We can build optimism, we can build confidence, we can build our ability to see a challenge as a learning opportunity. Now, the fourth insight is shifting perspective helps flexibility. Now, all these things I just talked about, this flexible self-regulation, flexibility sequence, flexibility mindset, all sounds wonderful. But as you're a human being, and I am too, you know that in a difficult time, it's sometimes really hard to connect to these elements of a flexibility mindset. We can feel a bit stuck. We can feel depleted, depressed, unable to connect to these things, which actually then enable us to engage with this flexibility sequence to see possibilities. And what can really help us in these moments where we feel stuck is tools that help us shift our perspective to move into this flexibility mindset. And when we think about our mindset as humans, it's important to acknowledge that we all have a different way of seeing the world. In coaching, we talk about this as a structure of interpretation, that we each have this really unique way of seeing and interpreting the world around us that pretty much no one else on the planet has. And this structure of interpretation that we have is influenced by all the different experiences and relationships that we've had that shape the narratives that we use to understand and navigate the world. And very often, a lot of what's happening internally for us, a lot of the narratives that we're following happen on autopilot. We might not even be aware that they're at work and that are maybe closing down possibilities for ourselves. I don't know if you've ever seen that puzzle. It's basically six dots that are arranged in a square. And the task is to, with your finger, try and join all of those dots together using only four lines and without lifting your finger. And if you're like me, you spent a long time trying to work this out before concluding it's completely impossible. And the reason why we do that is because without even realizing it, we put those six dots into a box. And then we don't let ourselves move our finger outside of that box, when the only way you can solve the puzzle is actually to extend the line outside of the box. It's the only way you're going to be able to connect the dots with just four lines. And when you see it, then you can't unsee it. But it's just amazing to witness how often we create these boxes for ourselves and don't even realize that we're trapped inside of them. And Ben and Rosamund Sander wrote a book, which I really like, that's called The Art of Possibility. And they basically say that because of this structure of interpretation, because of these narratives we have playing out inside of us, we're basically observing the world with a map that's already been drawn. So we think we're taking in new information, but in reality, we're often categorizing and fitting things in to what already exists as our way of understanding the world, into our settled frameworks and boundaries and models. And they have this beautiful quote in the book, which is, "It's all invented anyway, so we might as well invent a framework that enables and enhances life and opens possibilities." And I love that because it just highlights that when we're trying to shift perspective, it's not about telling ourselves a story or making things up, but it's rather saying, how I'm seeing things right now is limited. It's set by my structure of interpretation. So if I can imagine other ways of seeing things, that's going to open up possibilities for me. And that's essentially the core of what we're helping people to do in a coaching setting. But to circle back to why this is important for resilience, what we see time and time again is that perception and shifting our perception of things is critical to help us get into this flexibility mindset that we need for our own flexible self-regulation. And to come back to this work of George Bonanno and his colleagues again, one of the main outcomes that they took away from their work is that you can actually teach this positive constructing, this reframing, that we can make ourselves more or less vulnerable, more or less resilient, depending on how we think about things. And I'm sure you've heard of Martin Seligman, who's kind of the father of positive psychology. And his research also shows that when we're able to change our perspective, to change our explanatory style, we become much more able to cope with stress and become more resilient. Again, the external factors still really matter, but this internal stuff is really important. And so this might mean, for example, maybe helping ourselves shift from a narrative that everything's falling apart, everything's terrible, there's absolutely no hope, to, well, what's actually happening right now? Where are there possibilities? Where do I have agency to change things? And the ability to do this, this ability to change our perspective, is, I think, one of the central skills that we can build if we're looking to build our resilience, because it's foundational for this flexibility mindset and this flexibility sequence, which we heard before, is the key predictor of resilient outcomes. Now, when we're talking about changing perspective, I do want to put in the disclaimer that I'm not suggesting that when we feel uncomfortable or unpleasant emotions that we deny them or that we ignore fears when they're there. I see this a lot on social media, actually, this kind of good vibes only approach to life, which is what some professionals actually call toxic positivity. Because when we ignore unpleasant emotions or label these things as bad and don't let ourselves experience them and just reframe and shift as quickly as we can, that can actually become dangerous because we're denying what's actually going on. Because what we actually need to be able to do is acknowledge and accept without any judgment whatever's coming up for us, to be able to experience it and to go through what sometimes people call the tunnel of emotions. This idea of when we experience them, when we engage with them, when we process them, we move through the tunnel and to the light on the other side rather than getting stuck in the dark part in the middle of the tunnel. And a psychologist by the name of Dr. Barbara Friedrichsen wrote this in her book on emotions, where she said that resilient people, our studies have shown, are emotionally agile. They neither still themselves against negativity nor wallow in it. Instead, they meet adversity with clear eyes, superbly attuned to the nuances of their ever-changing circumstances. This allows them to meet the moment with a fitting emotional response, neither overblown nor insensitive. When the circumstances warrant, they can be moved to tears or shaken. They don't defend themselves against bad feelings. Yet neither do they overly identify with them. Rather, their negative emotions rise up like an ocean wave and then dissolve. Strong emotions move through them, which allows them to move on in their wake. And so when it comes to shifting perspective to really hold that space for being with what is arising and not denying it or pushing away or pretending it's not there, I've started to think about shifting perspective as learning the ABC. And I call it the ABC because it's a very easy way to remember, a very nice little acronym that helps us remember some steps we can take when we want to shift our perspective in a way that's also generative and healthy. And this is a little model that I didn't get from literature, but I've kind of developed it for myself in times when I'm feeling stuck and like I need a perspective change, but that's not coming to me very naturally. And what I've seen from myself and also from coaching clients that I've worked with is that when we are trying to shift our narrative or change our perspective, we really need to go through these steps of first pausing and becoming aware of what's going on and accepting what is happening. So often we're fighting against something that we don't want to be happening. We don't want it to be true. And then we pour all our energy into this resistance, which actually blocks us from processing it and moving forward and finding solutions. So the ABC of perspective shift that I use is comprised of A, which stands for accepting, B, which stands for being present and experiencing, and C, which stands for challenging perspective. So the A, accepting, is all about starting with that acceptance, this awareness and acceptance of what is going on And even if we don't like it, accepting that it's happening so that we can really observe from a more neutral place of what's actually going on. The B is about a pause. It's about being present and experiencing what's happening for you, allowing yourself to feel and name the emotions that are coming up, to see how you feel mentally and physically and emotionally in this situation, and to allow yourself to experience it. And I know that can sound overwhelming, particularly when things are very painful or uncomfortable. But what we see from a lot of the research around emotions is that when we allow ourselves to experience them as an observer, not identifying with them, then we're actually able to pass through them. We don't get stuck in the emotion tunnel. So that's the second part. And that really helps us avoid this risk of toxic positivity that can happen when we're trying to perspective shift. Then the C part of this model is about then challenging our perspective. So stepping back, investigating the narratives that are playing out and seeing how they might be limiting opportunities or opening up possibilities and seeing where you have some space to shift that for yourself. Now, all of these steps are really wonderful to work through with a coach or maybe a friend or someone who can support you. But we can also support ourselves to do this by just carving out some space and working with some questions to journal about it. And so I've pulled together some questions that can help you move through that model by yourself if you think it might be something useful for you to do. I found that actually really useful myself. Last year, I had this really bad back injury, and getting through it and bouncing back certainly needed this flexibility sequence and this flexibility mindset that we've been talking about. But there were definitely some low times where I didn't really feel able to engage with either of those things. And so what really helped me was just taking the space to work through this ABC, kind of journaling these questions that I'm going to share with you and seeing how that might help me shift my perspective and move into a space where I could engage more flexibly with what was going on. And actually, I've also seen this with a lot of my coaching clients. So I'm mostly working with women who are leading or exploring how to lead change in food and sustainability fields. And when the pandemic hit, so many of them were in positions of responsibility in organizations where people were being directly impacted on top of the stress and worry they had about themselves and their own families and communities. And so obviously they really needed support in that moment to work through these steps to see how it could help them engage with this flexible self-regulation, which would help them in the face of such a shock. So insight number five is, what does the personal have to do with the systemic? And I've framed this insight as a question because looking into the research around resilience actually left me with a question here. We've been talking a lot in this episode about what can we do as individuals to foster our own resilience, what actually helps us. But as people interested in sustainability or food systems or a just future on this planet in any way, then you're probably aware that there's this whole body of work and a lot of researchers and practitioners looking at resilience from a different angle, from this systems angle. So trying to understand what builds socio-ecological resilience, understanding how these interacting systems of people and nature can best be managed in the face of disturbances and surprises and uncertainty, and how this system can deal with change and continue to develop and respond. What I find extremely interesting is that as far as I can tell, there aren't that many linkages being made in published literature between socio-ecological resilience and the links to this individual or psychological or personal resilience that we've been talking about in this episode. And I've tried to look in the literature and I really don't find a lot. Then I started to think, okay, maybe I'm just not finding the right keywords. So I reached out to a bunch of different colleagues and researchers working in socio-ecological resilience. And pretty much all of them said, no, I think it's true. I don't really think anybody's looking at these links. Many said that, well, in the hallways where I work, we're actually talking about this or maybe discussing it over lunchtime, but it's not really being integrated so much into the work. It's still more happening at this reflective level. And so this is an area I'm really interested in, and I'd love to hear from you. If you know any interesting work in this area at the intersection of personal and systems resilience, tell me about it. Send it my way. I really want to dig into it. Or If you're working on it, let me know. Come on the podcast and chat with me about it. The last episode of this podcast, episode 34, was called Uplifting Diverse Voices to Cultivate Climate Resilience with Kylie Flanagan. And one of the reasons I did that episode of the podcast is that I felt like Kylie's book was a really nice example of people linking the personal with the planetary and just showing how so many people who work with these topics on the ground and the front lines at a grassroots level are really making a lot of connections already and understand from their lived experience how the personal and the planetary are connected. And most of the contributors to the book talked about what their own personal resilience and community resilience had to do with this bigger topic of climate resilience. So definitely check out the episode and check out the book if you would like a nice example of that. And a key message in the book that I really believe too, and that I think so important when we're talking about resilience, is that the challenges we face right now are just an incredible opportunity for us to really improve our underlying conditions and build better systems that are equitable and just for all. So we care about these topics not just to reduce emissions or halt biodiversity loss, of course, both of which are important, but because it's also a chance to fundamentally change systems that are not equitable or sustainable. And as one of the contributors to Kylie's book says, it's about actively creating something that's worth laying it all on the line for. If we're going to put in all of this effort and drive all of this change, then we really need to make it worthwhile by creating something better. And I think we're just going to see more and more work at this interface of the personal and the systemic, the personal and the planetary, because it's really important for us to make those connections. I think all of us at a simple level could agree that individual resilience impacts how our bigger systems function. We can't really have planetary resilience without personal resilience. We can expect that when those who you're sharing your lives with, whether that's at home or in the community or just simply on this planet, when we're able to connect with each other and with ourselves and to change our perspectives and to communicate and care and respect, then social resilience becomes much more likely. And all of the things we looked at that support personal resilience support social resilience. And what I also find really interesting at this interface of personal and planetary resilience is that a lot of these processes that we just talked about for personal resilience, so accepting, being with, and changing perspective, or the elements of the flexible self-regulation, all of these could actually also be applied to how we look at the issues that we're facing on our planet today. I think we close down so many possibilities because we don't question our perspectives, we don't challenge our perspectives and our assumptions and our mindsets that we bring into how we tackle these challenges. So what if we looked at the flexibility sequence as an approach that we can take to actually collectively tackle these issues that we face? To start by understanding what's happening, to explore the possibilities, to try out and adapt and iterate as we go, I think it's such a nice approach that really encourages action over paralysis. And this paralysis seems to be the hole that we keep falling into. Or how could a flexibility mindset open up for us how we view these issues? How might it help us see, well, what is actually going well? How can it help us trust ourselves better to respond and step into our agency? And how can it help us learn as we are going through this process and developing in response to these challenges we're facing? The last insight I wanted to share with you is insight number 6, when to stop building resilience. So this last thing I wanted to talk about is possibly one of the biggest and most destructive misuses of the concept of resilience at the moment. I've had countless coaching clients that come to me and say, I just don't think I'm very resilient. Why can't I cope better with these things that keep happening at work? I should be able to push through and bounce back faster. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm the first to say that we should always question our own role in things and look at what's happening internally and how we can shift things there. And when it comes to resilience, I think for a lot of people, maybe particularly for women, we keep falling into this trap of thinking, it's only us, and not looking at the external factors. So I think the issue for many of us is that we're being told to build our resilience to survive in systems that actually need to change? What if our discomfort in these settings is actually telling us that, you know what, things could be different here. This doesn't feel right for me. And maybe there's some things that we need to shift in the environment to make it feel more comfortable. So I think that's also interesting to start to understand the different types of discomfort or when we feel drained or that we're not resilient and how this actually relates to change. This question of, is this discomfort an important part of my personal change? Or is it an indicator that something around me needs to change? Or actually, is it both, which is very often the case? So this is a really tough one to disentangle, but I really think it's an important part of working in systems change. When does this idea of needing to build more resilience actually become destructive and stop us from creating the change around us that needs to happen? So as you reflect on this and in your quest to build your resilience, I would really invite you to reflect on that. To, as I said in the beginning, to think not only about the internal factors and things that you need to change, but also the external factors. And actually, just yesterday, I was reading an article in the scientific journal Nature, which was written by a doctoral student in neuroscience. And I think it sums up really nicely when resilience can actually cause harm. And she shares a story about how in doing what was needed to be done to complete her research project, she often felt that she was basically working herself to death. She had all kinds of physical symptoms, exhaustion that just wouldn't go away. And whenever she went to any of her peers to get help or any medical experts or supervisors, almost all of them told her, oh, you just need to build your resilience, kind of dismissing her symptoms as stress and just suggesting that it's her issue and she needs to become more resilient. And as you can understand, in that setting, she started to get pretty disenchanted with this idea that resilience could fix everything because it really wasn't her experience. And then after her own investigation and requesting a test, she actually discovered that she has the autoimmune disease lupus. And at the end of the article, she sums up what she learned from this experience with the following words. There is no one true definition of resilience or success. Instead, we must all follow the path that makes the most sense for our situation. Resilience doesn't mean pushing through unrealistic work goals and absorbing the damage at any cost. Personal wellness is an important part of long-term success, and even in the absence of external validation, we must be able to listen to our own bodies and make adjustments as needed. The scientific community must also consider how celebrating resilience can perpetuate systemic inequality. A Black student is not less resilient for leaving a program in which they experience racism or a lack of inclusion. Lupus is 9 times more common in women than in men, and up to 3 times more common in Black and Native American people than in white people. It's important to remember that we don't all share the same struggles and challenges, and a solution that works for one person might not do so for others. To put it broadly, tenacity alone can be maladaptive when adhering to something that isn't working. And after I read this, it made me think about these lyrics from the Coldplay song Clocks, which says, am I part of the cure or am I part of the disease? I'm not going to sing it for you. I'll spare you that. But I think we need to be asking ourselves the same thing about resilience. When is it part of the cure and when is it part of the disease? Okay, so to wrap up, we've explored a lot of things here. Thanks so much for staying with me so far. Let me quickly recap what we've covered in this episode, and then I'm going to share some practical exercises that you can do now or whenever you feel you need them to build your resilience. We've explored what does it mean, actually, when we talk about personal resilience? What are some of the myths and what are the realities around not only what it means, but also how we can build it for ourselves? We've looked at 3 key things that can help us support building our own resilience: a flexibility sequence, a flexibility mindset, and perspective shifting. We've talked about this interesting idea of how personal resilience is linked to planetary resilience, and I want to hear your thoughts on that. And then finally, we've just reflected again that resilience is about internal and external factors, and we shouldn't only push ourselves to be more resilient when the systems around us also need to change. So I hope this has given you some food for thought. If you want to keep digging in and seeing how you can apply this in your life, I've put together some exercises for you, which are based on some of the tools that I shared here today. So if you want to go through them, you can click on the link in the show notes and download a worksheet which outlines these three different exercises for you. Firstly, a set of journaling questions or maybe conversation questions that you can do with yourself or someone else to help you work through this ABC of perspective shifting. Secondly, a flexibility sequence journaling, or again, maybe conversation questions to help you explore your own options in the face of a challenge. And then finally, the four S's, or a personal resilience plan, which you can use to help you identify what are the things that have helped you in the past in the face of different shocks, and how can you use them when new things come along that challenge you. I hope engaging with these practices is really enriching for you. I hope it's really generative and sparks some new insights and potentially put some more tools in your toolbox that can help you in the face of challenges that you encounter in your life or in your role in trying to create change. So if you've got a topic that you would like us to explore here, or an amazing guest that you think I just have to talk to, then please don't hesitate to drop me an email to podcast@thegrateful.com. I really love to hear from you and also hopefully get some of your great ideas here on the show. So if you're finding these podcasts helpful or you're enjoying listening to them, then please go ahead and subscribe or leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcast. That also helps you make sure that you never miss an episode here. Thanks so much for being here. Looking forward to seeing you in our next episode, which is actually the last one of this season. We're traveling to South Africa to hear about an amazing initiative that is empowering youth through regenerative agriculture. Looking forward to see you there.